Welcome to Series 2 of the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In Series 2, we have already looked at the anthology and the songs they gave away, so join us now as we continue with selections from the Live at the BBC albums. Welcome to Episode 54, and welcome to Glad Paul Over Abbott.
Hey, excellent. Hello, everyone. Appropriate.
Are you glad Paul Over?
Let's say yes.
Just say yes.
For the sake of of keeping up the facade of jolliness. It's not really. I'm all right.
Yeah, good stuff. Good, good. Don't forget.
Oh, just kidding.
Okay. Don't forget you can follow us at @big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or email us at bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And please like and share our posts if you are following us on social media. And please let people know about the podcast. And a good way to do that is to drop a review and or rating. Paul, as usual, is there anything you'd
Paul
like to
Paul, as usual,
about?
That's not a phrase.
Paul, as usual. would anything you'd like to tell our listeners about before we go all beat?
Well, I would like to point people to, if they haven't heard it, I did a sudden and unexpected episode of other podcast, The Head Ballet.
Yes, you did.
Which is all about novelty songs. And I was introduced by my friend and a couple of time guests to the show, Ben Baker, to a piece of music that struck me so amazingly that I just couldn't resist doing an episode about it. It's a song called The Mechanical Man from 1966.
Yeah.
So if anyone wants to look up the Head Ballet podcast and listen to that, it's a fascinating, silly, wonderful, stupid bit of music that I had to just talk about. I will be coming back with some new Head Ballet episodes soon, but this one just, it couldn't wait.
Mm. Yes, I've heard it. It's very good. Yeah, very worth a listen to. You will probably more than likely not know the song, but that's the fun of finding out about it, I think.
Yeah,
it's very good. From me, I think I've said it last week, but it's still February, so my latest song, Kings of Nothing, should still be the one I am circulating and trying to get people to listen to. And if you've got any outlets for music or anything like that where you can broadcast or play or anything like that, please get in touch with me and let me know, because I've got a few things I'm been quite keen to get people listening to. So yeah, go and have a look for that. It's all linked in the podcast description, as is Paul's band's debut album.
Yes, that's coming soon.
Yeah. So
order that.
Paul, it should be on this Beatles Day, the 21st of February.
Yes, okay. Well, let's have a little slice of Beatles life from 1961. Mm-hmm. So we are teetering on the edge of success here. They're not quite anywhere at this point, okay, but they're getting somewhere. So essentially what we've got is a band that's going to go and play some gigs. We know that. That's a thing that happens.
Okay.
But the circumstances leading up to this, you could, you know, obviously go and read all the books. There's tons of stuff. So I'm talking about 21st of February 1961, but we have to basically say that in November the year before, we've got the deportation of George and then Paul and Pete from Hamburg, and John stays on a bit longer, and Stu Sutcliffe obviously stays on with Astrid longer still. The funny thing is, at this point, you know, they sort of come back in disarray and they don't know what's going to happen. I mean, Paul goes and gets a job, which is,
what does he do?
Beatles anathema working, really.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, he gets like a delivery job over Christmas, like a parcel loading job. And then after that, he goes to an electrical coil winding factory called Massey and Coggins, where, like, because he's got a couple of O-levels and stuff, they're immediately tipping him for like, well, you might be able to do something in this company. And him being him, you know what Paul McCartney's like. He'd have had a sense of pride about what he does to an extent. He would have liked to have done well. He's sort of under pressure from his dad.
Yeah.
Nobody knows when John gets back to Liverpool. He doesn't tell anyone. And they don't know about when he's back until George bumps into him in the Jacaranda.
Right.
So the band's like sort of nowhere. And then Stu eventually comes back because he's not feeling well. He's got tonsillitis. And so he comes back and he stays with his family in Ullett Road, which is literally 10-minute walk from my house. And at this point, they start playing again. with Stu on bass too. So on this particular day, it's 21st of February 1961, they have a lunchtime session at the Cavern.
Right.
So it's only ever their second gig at the Cavern, I think, this one.
Okay.
And Stu's there on bass, you know, and at this point he's played with them in Hamburg long enough that he's all right.
Yeah.
Paul doesn't really want to be the bass player. You know, they've asked a couple of other folk who've done some bits and pieces, but, you know, they've got this strange scenario going on. But then they've got an evening show at the Casanova Club on London Road, which is in the city centre, in a building that isn't there anymore, I don't think. Although, ironically, I think where it was is there's a little row of shops that once had a tiny little record shop in it, like this little sort of... These things look like little temporary huts, but they're still there. I think it's a Jesus shop now, you know, a religious things shop. But once upon a time, it was a record shop, and it was a place where I bought my first copy of Sgt. Pepper on vinyl.
Okay.
Because I always had it on tape.
Yeah.
And I bought a copy on vinyl because it was 50p.
Right.
And
that's good.
That was a long time ago. Yeah. But I reckon that's where the Casanova Club was. So they play an evening performance at the Casanova Club and then an evening performance at Litherland Town Hall.
Oh, right.
Up in North Liverpool. So, you know, they've sort of come back and they've got back to, suddenly they're playing a lot in all these places. And part of the problem here, though, is Paul's having to sort of bunk off work to go and do these lunchtime sessions at the Cavern. And John's basically giving him an ultimatum of like, well, it's either the job or this.
Or the band.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do 1961 again in the next episode. But on the 28th of February, I think that's like the flashpoint where John's basically like, if you don't come and do this show at lunchtime, then that's it, you're done.
Ooh. That would be a good dramatic point for episode, I don't know, 7 of series 1 of the Beatles epic that Netflix will need to make one day.
Yeah, you know, and Paul has literally bunked off over a wall, literally climbed a wall to leave work.
Yeah.
And this time, I think he climbs the wall and just doesn't come back.
Yeah.
That's the, you know, on the 28th, I think it is. So it's a strange, I mean, it's a funny period as well, because Stu's back, that he's trying to apply for becoming an art college teacher in the autumn. He wants to do that course. But obviously we know he ends up going back to Hamburg to study art there. But it's probably in this period where he sustains the injury that may have been the, you know, the event that killed him ultimately. So it's a very significant point where the Beatles are sort of coalescing into another shape off the back of all their Hamburg experience, and people are weaving in and out and stuff like that, and decisions are being made. So, you know, and they're heading off on an interesting new year from this point.
Okay. Great stuff. Just out of interest, I'm sure everyone listening, or most people listening, will know this already, but is there a book that, rather than just say, this happened and this happened and this happened, has turned it into a narrative, trying to base it on you know, has dramatised it as such? Is there a book that's done that already?
Do you know what? I don't know that. I've not read one. I know that there are books and there's been little comic book adaptations of things where they've dramatised stuff.
Yeah.
But the person to ask, of course, would be Joe Wisby from the Beatles Books podcast, because if there is one or more, he will certainly have them.
Okay.
There we go. We might tag him into this when we're talking about it, and he might be able to offer some suggestions for people looking for dramatised narrative things.
I'm just trying to find the source of the Netflix series I want to happen within my lifetime.
But obviously Stu Sutcliffe's part in this is one of the triggers for a lot of those on-screen biopics.
Yeah, I remember Backbeat Beatles, isn't it?
Which Backbeat, focuses Birth on of that. The Beatles, things like that.
But it's just a chapter. It is an interesting chapter, and there's lots of drama in there going on, isn't there?
Yeah, but all those films tell the story in totally different ways. When I was doing my master's about biopics, my big dissertation, I was comparing the different forms of narrative about how Stu Sutcliffe sustained this injury, and every single portrayal of it is totally different.
Well, and as is the way with historical events, isn't there?
The funny thing is, although we don't know for definite what's happened with Stu, I mean, there's a pretty heavy weight towards one incident.
Yeah.
None of these go anywhere close to sort of representing that for dramatic purposes. You know, if you're actually telling a story on the screen, the reality is very often...
Yeah.
It's not the thing you want to show.
Exactly, that's it. That's it.
Odd.
Okay, well, that's great stuff. Interesting time. It feels like a time of stories and very, you know, very tumultuous kind of
a lot of the legend of them becoming the you know, the local supergroup, the yeah. Beatles in Liverpool and yeah. environs is then.
And hung in a balance. A very,
yeah. It did, so often did.
Okay, so then let's get on with what will be disc. No, I knew I'd say disc, but I meant to say volume two of Live at the BBC. Disc one, which is what we're looking at today, with five songs pulled out to talk about in detail, but we'll go through the whole track listing briefly as well. And just before we start on that, although we've done a lot of the terms up front, just to remind ourselves that this came out a little bit later, didn't it, from the first volume, and there's quite a lot of repetition, but they are different versions of some of the same songs and some ones that hadn't been heard before.
Yes, so essentially, we've between Live at the BBC Volume 1, Live at the BBC Volume 2, a touch of stuff on the anthology and the bootleg 63 release, we have a certain amount of the things that the Beatles recorded for the BBC over the, you know, those early years. We certainly don't have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And partly it's because, like you say, there's a lot of duplication. They couldn't play something new every single time they went into the studio for the BBC sessions.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that are repeated that they play four or five times in different recordings, and they very rarely ever just clipped something from a show and literally repeated the performance. I think towards the very end of their association with the BBC, there were some things that they'd play, you know, that had been broadcast before, but generally speaking, everything was another version of.
Yeah, which is very nice of them to feel they needed to do that. I mean, it was kind of, they were pre-syndication of kind of the music video, the single. They liked to actually give the audience something novel for the time they were listening rather than just, well, hear our record again, which they're hearing on every other show anyway. So,
yeah, and there's not many ways to listen to radio other than the BBC, so they had to have that relationship with them. It's really important. But yeah, this collection, which is actually called On Air, Live at the BBC Volume 2.
Yeah.
It's got that strange little title to it as well. That comes out on the 11th of November 2013, at the same point where they reissue the first Live at the BBC.
Yeah.
And it comes out with little fanfare. What they did was, whereas Live at the BBC had the Baby It's You single alongside it, this didn't really have a physical single release, but they did a promo video for Words of Love, which is like the first musical track on this, which is like newsreel footage, home cinema footage of the band, and a load of animation over the top of it.
Yeah.
Sort of doing a little mini tale of the Beatles going up and down the length of the country to go between Liverpool and London to record. And it's fine, but that was the only real promo that was done for this.
Okay.
But it still gets to number 12 in the UK album charts,
Giving
it sort of silver record status. Gets to number 7 in the Billboard albums chart in America. And there's a couple of unique things on here. Obviously, there's a whole load of speech tracks that are taken from it. And there is, in fact, both discs have quite long extended interviews at the end of them, which aren't on they don't have an equivalent of that on the original album.
Yeah.
But we won't be talking about them because they sort of stand alone in their own way. It's an odd one. Like I said before, I don't know this album as well as the first one because, you know, I got the first album in 1994 and it's now 2022. And I've been listening to it intensively over those years. This I've only had since it came out in 2013. And it's not quite, it doesn't flow quite as well as Live at the BBC Volume 1. But it's still a brilliant thing, and they should just keep doing them to get all the sessions out.
Yeah.
They should just put everything out.
Not knowing they were going to do a volume two, they creamed the best off on the first one, didn't they? And then later down the line thought, with technology now, we can make these a bit more listenable than we thought they were, and actually, why not? But yeah, I think there's a certain amount of... There's literally songs that we've already heard of on the first volume anyway, isn't there? And therefore, these were probably the second best one when they were originally kind of putting them together. But there are stuff, there is, like I say, there's stuff that's new and there's stuff that's not on there, and it's worth a listen to, always is. And I'm enjoying listening to them all. So shall we go through them then, track by track, until we hit our focus tracks and talk about them in detail?
Right. Well, let me start then. We start with a speech track called And Here We Are Again, a little intro bit, setting the glib tone of Beatles interviews that it carries on.
Yeah.
And I mean glib from both the interviewer and the band themselves. They both sort of found a relationship between the various DJs and people they worked with. So it's very funny. Deliberately glib is what I'm saying. Yeah. They're not being standoffish. Then there goes into that version of Words of Love, like I say, that they use for the broadcast, the Buddy Holly song. Then we have How About It Gorgeous, the strange bit where George has to read out someone's letter about Bill and Ben, the flowerpot men, dying.
Oh, yeah, and he says, I don't like Ben, his voice is high-pitched and whiny or something. I hope he dies. I hope he sets on fire.
Flowerpot would be killed.
Yeah, it's something weird.
Not dies, killed. He wants I mean, I remember the flowerpot men being on telly when I was little, but I never remember being so angry with them that I wanted them to be explode when a man sang at them.
And that you would feel like you needed to write into your favourite beat combo to tell them to say that on air.
No, absolutely. Yeah. But that leads us into track 4, which is Do You Want to Know a Secret?
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice. I like that version, actually. Mm. Then we have another version of Lucille, so that little Richard rocker with Paul singing it. Then we have a little bit of speech called Hey Paul, where... So it's the presenter there, Lee Peters, asks Paul, I believe you've just had your 21st birthday party. Was it good? And then he turned it into a little jokey section.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I'm sure he did have a good time, except that's where John ended up clobbering Bob Wooler.
Right.
You know, and had to sort of, and that got in the newspapers and Brian had to smooth that over.
Right.
You know, that's the incident that John's referring to in the Get Back film when he says, I've had wine, remembered Bob Wooler.
Right.
It's like, oh yeah, that's a hilarious assault. Yeah. So anyway, but this is like him asking about his 21st birthday. So there you go. Then we get onto a version of Anna, Go to Him. We have a speech thing called Hello. And then that's quite a good one. That's John being very silly on that one. Then we have a version of Please Please Me. A version of Misery, and then we get to our first pick, I'm Talking About You. I'm talking about you. Nobody but you. Come on, give me through. I'm just trying to get a message to you. Wow! Let me tell you about a girl I know. I'm talking about you, Paul. Well, I'm talking about you. I'm talking about you.
I'm talking about you. I think you meant to say.
I did try and say that, but all the words just moved around.
What we understood.
I didn't. Anyway, this is one of the unique exclusives to this record set, isn't it? So this is a Chuck Berry song that, not really one of his most well-known ones by any means.
No.
And this is a good Beatles version. This was the opening track on the new Jukebox Hits album from 1961, which was also a single release. So they won't have been, you know, they've only known this for a couple of years tops at this point.
Yeah.
And it sort of comes out. I mean, this period of Chuck Berry's career is tricky, let's say. He sort of vanishes off out of the... you know, all the magazines and the album releases and single releases, because he's been arrested for transporting a minor over state lines.
Right, okay.
And is about to end up going to jail in a little bit. He's doing a lot of appeals against his conviction, and then eventually goes to prison for a year and a half.
Right, yeah. So, I knew there was something
dodgy
went on with him. I just didn't know what it was.
But this so this single sort of appears in this downtime, let's say.
Yeah.
For Chuck Berry, but they obviously take to it. And then this is from Saturday Club on the 16th of March, 1963. And this is one of the occasions where they're singing live, because apparently the planned pre-record they couldn't do because he had a cold.
Okay.
So.
Fair enough. So they're actually singing, as in they're on air live, playing live, not they're on air live talking to the presenter and then playing the tape of the thing they recorded earlier. To be played on that show,
You know, this is going out live.
Cool. I wondered if well, I mean, obviously one of the reasons you picked this one is that there's less novel songs on this side to talk about. However, this also has a very notable bass line, doesn't it?
It does, yes. I think that's one of the reasons we should mention it specifically.
You may have picked it up from the clip I'll have played. But anyway, I'll get to that. The recording on this, though, is quite poor, unfortunately, isn't it? The quality of loss is quite high. So what you get mostly is the bass and bass drum. That seems to be the thing they've been able to pull out of the mix a bit, haven't they, for somehow?
Yeah, to give it some sort of weight.
Yeah, so you get a lot of that. Basically, what you know, they reuse, shall we say, they repurpose for I Saw Her Standing There later down the line, bass line, the good old do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, which appears in a couple of things, but it's quite notably this one, isn't it? And
Paul basically confessed to this, he ripped off the bass line for this, from this song to become the bass line for I Saw Her Standing There.
Which you can kind of do with these kind of bass lines because they're all very similar, but this is one of the few variations of kind of rock and roll bass lines which stands apart. And if you were to do it from then on, people would go, well, that's just I Saw Her Standing There. And actually, when they were doing it, no one, I don't know how many people were saying, well, that's just I'm talking about you, because I don't know how large it would have loomed in anybody's kind of a memory at that point or not, or how much impact it would have had on the listening public to go, well, I know that. Anyway, you've done that before. But it doesn't really matter because I think I Saw Her Standing There develops the song that sits above the bass line well enough to be worth that.
And the notoriously litigious Chuck Berry was probably didn't know anything about this band from England when I Saw Her Standing There comes out on Please Please Me.
Yeah.
And so doesn't do what he does later with, you know, Come Together and sue anyone. So
yeah. So it's John's vocal, isn't it? And you can some very reverby guitar going on, but the music itself is very Chuck Berry. It's a good song. I'm not sure if it's the recording quality sapping a bit of the energy, or because it's slower, or because John, I don't know, because we've been listening to quite a few Little Richard ones with Paul really being able to open up. We don't get as much of that on this one. I'm less enamored by this song. I think I've heard the original to this one on a Chuck Berry vinyl I've got. I think I've listened to his version on vinyl and thought, oh yeah, today I saw it. This must be the one they took it from. And they thought, I can see why they, you know, it's a better, it gets used in a better song, I think, eventually. It's okay. It's just a little bit forgettable. I don't know. I think I'm leaning more towards the Little Richard than the Chuck Berry this time.
It is. It's an interesting one out of all the Chuck Berry songs. Like I say, it's not his version of I'm talking about his own version. Chuck Berry's version isn't very well known when you put it up against Roll Over Beethoven or Johnny B. Goode or anything like that. Because it's got a different sort of feel to it. And while I reckon that they nail a pretty good version of it, even though I think John flips around verses and lines and things like that, it's not one of Chuck's best.
No.
By any means, in terms of that sort of ability Chuck Berry had to tell a really good teenage story, as it were, like he does with so many other rest of his songs. It's the lyrics are a bit clunky, and the meter that he sings it
it sits in a kind of middle ground, not really going one place or another. As far as breaking out, the chorus doesn't move enough away from what's going on elsewhere, but I gave it 58 for music because I thought, well, it's still a pretty good rocker.
It's simple and effective, but not
one of the best ones. Yeah. So performance-wise, it's hard to judge a lot of this because of the recording. So, you know, caveats. I mean, I think it's deliberate that there's a whole section where everything drops out, but the bass doing the doo-doo-doo. There's a bit where he's singing and it's just the bass. That's what it sounds like happens. But I don't know if that's because we can't hear nuances going on in the guitars. They're playing it all right. And John's doing okay. I just don't think there's anything for him to get stuck into, like I said. I think the guitar solo is okay. The end's a bit scrappy, I think.
The original fades out, though, so they just have to come
up with
an end.
They just do a good old, I think we'll stop now type of do-do-do-do.
I think George's guitar is quite good on this. I think he grabs it and runs with it pretty well compared to the record, you know, the original. So.
Okay, yeah. I mean, what I've done, because of its quality and stuff and not being able to really hear too much of what's going on as well as you'd like to, is I've given it another 58 for performance, so level peggings.
Uh-huh.
Song choice. We kind of already covered it. I think it's just a bit average in comparison to kind of Richard Numbers that we've been hearing and some other songs I think we'll cover on this side. We know about the bass line, and it's great. It's great to see how he would happily play. I mean, had he written... What year are we on when he's playing this? Has he written I Saw Her Standing There by now?
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not shy of like going, look what we're...
No, it is quite nice, I suppose, in that sense of it being like, well, I Saw Her Standing There has become a rock and roll standard all of its own, and it's nice that there's a Beatles release with this on it.
Yeah.
So you can actually point and say, well,
yeah,
have a
we're
look
not,
at
not
that.
Pretending that was... it didn't exist. They're not saying it's not like My Lovely Horse and Father Ted, where they're hoping everyone's forgotten it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
For anyone, American listeners that you don't know what Father Ted is, just look it up.
Or don't, because the person who wrote it is a
Hey, there's
a horrible,
other people involved
man.
As well.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah.
Yeah, the actors and the production crew and all those people. So
yeah. One person who wrote it is a very horrible person.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think as far as a song on a album, there would have been a bit of a... This wouldn't have sat any, but definitely would have been a disappointment compared to having a Twist and and Shout or Kansas City. It wouldn't have been worth putting this on instead of something like that.
No, I don't think so.
So, and like I said before, I like Chuck Berry, but having listened to that two-disc collection of his stuff, which is only one of two volumes, which I don't know if I've got the other volume, the big famous ones stick out and then the rest sound like not quite as good as the big famous ones as much, and it can blend together a bit for me, and this is in the blend together category a bit. So, but it's not far off, so I'm going to give it 59 for song choice, which gives it 58.3 overall.
I'm amazed you didn't just choose another 58 to make the sum so much easier to not return a point something.
I don't know, I just felt, yeah, I thought that would be just too much.
You've got a system, Gary, far be it from me to criticise it.
Well, things are a bit late for that now.
Right.
But anyway, 58.3 overall, Paul, so where do we go from here?
Well, we go to track 12, which is another speech bit called A Real Treat, and it's Ringo's reading out some cards. Oh, yeah. And one of them, this great thing about this is it's the one that comes from someone in Blackburn House, which is literally opposite Liverpool Institute.
Yeah.
Diagonally opposite it, more or less. And I love this little snippet of... There's a great thing about the Beatles' relationship to each other is that John makes a quip about, oh, I went to college there. And then Ringo says, oh, college pudding. You know, because Ringo didn't get much schooling, certainly didn't go to college, you know, because his illness and stuff.
Oh, this is where they're on about someone Yates, isn't it? And they're like, we don't know him, we don't remember him.
Yeah, yeah, Ronnie Yates or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's... but yeah, this is... No, or is that like this one? I don't know. I think there might be a couple of ones where they're talking about people locally.
Oh, okay.
But it's the fact that, yeah, Ringo accuses John of being posh.
Yeah.
Which is relative to him. He is.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. Ringo was from the kind of roughest part of town, wasn't he?
Well, pretty rough. The Dingle wasn't great, no. But certainly compared to Walton and Menlove Avenue and all that stuff. But anyway, that leads us into Boys by Ringo.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a little chat called Absolutely Fab. And we have John... We have George singing Chains.
Mm-hmm.
We have a nice version of Ask Me Why, which I do love. And then Till There Was You.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to track 18, Lend Me Your Comb.
Your mommy was gold. Your baby was shouting, let's we come in. The way we went out. Guessing you was fun, honey, but thanks for the day. Time has come to run, honey, but you know, baby, it's a good leg day.
Lend me your comb, Paul. That's, if you could see me, you'd realise.
I know, I was trying to think how I could phrase something to explain that you have no hair.
Yes, by choice, because I've lost a lot of it. But the bits I don't have, I've shaved off, so.
Well,
I have no need for a comb.
I won't lend you one then, if that's the answer. Right, this is from the Pop Go the Beatles show on the 16th of July 1963, recorded a couple of weeks before that.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is a song that existed in a couple of versions, but the one that the Beatles know is the Carl Perkins version from the B-side of Glad All Over, another song
that's
going to crop up as well. Yeah, so it's something they would have known pretty well, and we're back to a bit of strange, silly rockabilly.
It is rockabilly. Good. I've got that right. Tick. Yes, it is strange, and I would say it defies convention because it is rockabilly, but then it kind of does a thing of... It goes between two different feels, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It does switch tempo.
It moves between that rockabilly stilted cha-cha-cha thing that was confusing me last week, kind of do-do-do, cha-cha-cha feel, like into more of a jazzy walking bass line type of section.
Yes.
Kind of a shuffle section, which is interesting to hear because actually I can't think, other than in their later years when they literally switch between maybe a 3-4 and a 4-4 in a rock song, hearing them do much changing of, you know, they most of their songs stick with the feel beginning to end, don't they?
It's not a common thing in rock and roll particularly to have such a feel shift, because so much of rock and roll particularly is about feel and it's about groove and it's about locking in and have it doing one thing, and the same sort of thing carries on into pop and rock. Whereas this is an example in rockabilly where they've got sort of, you have one section of feel and then you have the middle eight is marked out by going into a slightly different tempo and a slightly different rhythm pattern.
Yeah.
You know, enough that it's worth going, oh, you notice that.
You have to stop. Yeah, if you were
it's
dancing.
Not like they just change the chords.
Yeah, you'd have to completely stop and go, oh, I'm changing now. It's a different feel altogether. And it also, along with the words and the whole story of this, puts it slightly in your territory, I think. It starts to edge towards the novelty a bit.
I think it does, yeah. Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of songs like this, but it's one of those sort of more explicitly about like kids, you know, sneaking off to couple up, to get together, and it's rather than it being like drippy romantic version of that, it's the practicality.
Yeah,
what I quite like in the lyrics of this is even though Carl Perkins didn't write this, it's that weird sort of jokey practicality of like, oh, make sure your hair's, but you know, straighten your tie, comb your hair, make sure it looks like we haven't been rolling around on the bed.
Yeah, because you've got your girlfriend's house.
A moment.
And you've got to leave and you've got to say bye-bye to her mum and dad as you're walking her out.
Yeah.
And you've got to, can't kind of come.
You can't shin down the drain pipe.
They know you're there, so you can't just disappear. And you can't come out looking with your hair all a fluster. Yeah, that's basically it, isn't it? So it's got like that.
They're only a step away from, rather than saying straighten your tie, like zip up your fly or something that, to be in all honesty.
Which maybe they started out like that and then thought, no. But yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if that John would clearly sing something like that at some point, I'm sure.
Yeah. And so it's a joke, because it's a jokey song about tidying yourself up before, you know, as you're leaving your partner's house, so that their parents don't think there's been any funny business. And as such, it has a playful feel with how it changes the beat between those different sections. It's a listener song. Like, listen to the song because it's got a, you know, it's a funny story song. And yeah, but as a result, we have a bit of a strange beast, which is neither here nor there, but fun all the same. So it's not like, I don't think it would be the top of many people's record picks. You just be aware of it and go, oh yeah, that song, you know, fair enough. So I'm going to give it 57 for music because... I think it's okay, but it's not, you know, it's
okay.
It's a delivery of a punchline via music. Performance. I like Ringo's drumming in this.
I do too.
Yeah, his ability to switch between those two feels is great, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If what people should do, and maybe you should drop in a little clip of this, Gary,
okay,
is find the version that they do at the Star Club.
Yeah.
So the Star Club recording, in the sections where they change, Ringo's drums are like, he goes mad. He's amazing. You know, when I've talked about Ringo like doing live stuff where you see the others look at him like, he is such a rocker.
Yeah.
This Star Club recording, this is one of the examples where Ringo's drums just sound immense, like proper big beat stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really worth a listen, the Star Club version of this.
Oh, cool. Well, okay. Well, I shall drop a clip of that in here. Well, wasn't that good, Paul?
It was good, yeah.
Yeah, no, he's very good, and
he's a good lad.
he's having to keep it rolling along, and there's a lot of Tommen's work going on to keep it going in those as I say, those cha-cha-chari sections. And yeah, the solo is good. Singing is fun. I like how Paul goes into a kind of a club singer voice when he does the jazzy sections.
He
hammers it up a bit, I think, when he's not doing the bit with John in the verses. Yeah, it's a good rendition, I think. I'm just not so sure about the song or something I want to hear much of, but what they do with it is fun. So I'm giving it 67 for performance.
I think it's worth that partly because of the John and Paul harmony.
Yeah.
As well, because although the Carl Perkins version, you know, it's Carl Perkins, his has got this harmony in, and his harmony sort of is in that Everly Brothers style that John and Paul can just switch into like that type thing. So, and it also, of course, has Paul singing the word sugar bugger, which wouldn't have meant anything to him and doesn't really mean anything at all. It's like Carl Perkins is singing sugar bug, like it's a sort of little sugar twee bug. Term about a sort of little pest that they get on sugar crops.
Okay.
You know, but to anyone in Liverpool in 1961, 2, 3, whatever, it's going to be sugar bugger.
What does
that mean? So I imagine that would have been a moment that would have made them laugh as well, because it's such a strange phrase.
Yeah. Oh, cool. On to song choice then. I mean, I pretty much said it already. The issue for me is that I'm not mad keen on the song anyway. Not because I don't dislike it, it just feels a bit throwaway. Like, it's a jokey song, it's a bit of fun. It's a nice idea for a pop record. I'd say maybe a one-hit wonder, but you're saying it's Carl Perkins, so he did loads of hits.
Yeah, but, it's like the B-side. It's a Carl Perkins B-side. Yeah. I don't know quite what the careers of Carol Hughes or Bernie Nee, which is a great name. Both. I'm not making that up.
Somebody's gone to the A&E with an injured knee. Yeah. What name, please? Bernie Nee.
And what's your problem? Bernie Nee.
Went with that.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the Hughes or Nee's careers to say whether this was sort of one-offs for them at all. But
I think their problem might have been that their duet name was Hughes and Knees.
No, it wasn't a duet. It was two different people.
Yeah.
Two different people.
Okay.
Bernie Nee stands alone.
Bernie Nee.
There we are.
But it's not in the boys' territory. I imagine it being I definitely can imagine them doing it on stage as a bit of a tongue-in-cheek laugh. But when we get to their recording career, this wouldn't go anywhere near anything.
I agree with this one, really. There wouldn't have been a place for this on anything that they do.
So I'm still giving it 45 for song choice, because it's not like
it's a fun song, but it's fun.
So I can imagine them. They did the right kind of song for this kind of thing, but not in general. So that gives it 56.3 overall, and we continue with the one that I think was where they're talking
about.
So the
one that you referred to before, track 19 is Form Lower 5e,
which
is another thing. That's the guy from the Liverpool Institute, isn't it?
Ronnie
Yates. Talking about. So they start talking about teachers and stuff like that. Mm. I do love the fact that they're getting, they're this little band from Liverpool, but by this point, 1963, they're a national band, not an international band yet, a national band, so that the people are writing from Liverpool to them via the BBC or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating thing.
It really plays into the fact that they weren't a manufactured kid next door band. They really were people from the streets of the town. They were working class, albeit different levels of working class, different areas. You could even border on the middle class with parts of it. But they're from the town they're from. They weren't put together by a talent scout. They were put together and then they...
No, Epstein didn't handpick a bunch of people to make a band,
He didn't manufacture backstories and try and make it out like they were something they weren't. They really were. And when you've got them, just their old classmates writing in and they're talking about, I was in 5E.
Yeah. It's a fascinating little thing for that to exist. But that leads us then on to track 20, which is the Hippie Hippie Shake.
With the Hippie Hippie Shake,
the Hippie Hippie Shake, Paul.
I can't think of anything silly to say for that, really. Yeah. So this is, yeah, there's a version of this on the first album, Live at the BBC album.
Yeah.
Which is really good. I think this is the slightly less good version.
Hmm.
But because we didn't talk about it on the last one.
Yeah, if you held it over.
I held it over for this. Because it's I think we mentioned briefly, it's got that sort of almost like the Twist and Shout status to it.
Yeah.
Of it being, except I think Twist and Shout has the edge because it's got the full band singing. This is just a Paul rocker. But it's a song from 1959 done by a guy called Chan Romero.
Right.
He was only 17 when he recorded it.
Yeah.
Even though he records it with an amazing group of session musicians, like people like Barney Kessel on guitar and things like that. But it wasn't a hit, you know. So it doesn't chart anywhere, apparently, except Australia. It gets to number three, Chan Romero's version. But somehow, apparently, Bob Wooler, the DJ in the Cavern, gets a copy, plays it, and Paul's like, what's that? I want to do that. Can I borrow it?
Mm.
You know, because it's got these weird oohs in it. You know, I can't do it as high as Chan Romero's version because he's literally octaves up doing this thing. But clearly it's something in it sort of triggered something in Paul, and it would be one that loads of the groups did.
Yeah.
But and it ends up being the most famous version is that version by the Swinging Blue Jeans,
another
Liverpool band. That's the one most people would know.
Which we spoke of briefly.
We did, yeah.
Does it end up on a soundtrack album, their version or anyone's version for something? Is it?
Oh, I think it's used on all sorts of things. It was a very popular song.
I just feel like it's more popular than just having heard it on that Merseybeat vinyl that we had. But did we play it in one of the? No, we wouldn't.
We played it in the beat band thing.
But this, when it wasn't that a Beatles? Was that when we were doing other things as well as the Beatles? That's probably where I've got myself confused. Then was playing it side by side with Beatles music and thinking, but yeah, okay.
The song was included in the films The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Oh, I don't know.
That won't be where you first know it from.
No, I won't know.
Neither will X-Men First Class or Uncle Buck, probably. Although I'd have heard
of that. No, although that would have been closer to the time than those other two.
Austin Powers.
No.
So it's been in lots and lots of things.
Yeah, it's a great song. Yes. You'd think most people would know it, but it's hard to nail down the version you'd know it from, really. But it's a very familiar song to me. And as we discussed briefly last week, something that was around... Was at least on, we know it was on a vinyl, whether that's where I'm really hearing it from, I don't know. And I was kind of half thought it was Beatles until obviously we did an entire series proving it isn't. it's a solid rocker with all the breaks and everything. It's a bit like a Little Richard number, again, even though it isn't. It breaks straight in with the chorus, which is obviously a trick that George Martin would later need to... kind of remind them to keep on doing with their songs, you know, just start straight off with the hippie hippie shake stuff. It doesn't take its time to get to it. It starts with the good bit.
Well, I mean, the thing with this song is it's kind of all good bit, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's just, such a brief thing. It's just like it just hits, goes, and then stops.
Yeah, exactly. It just keeps returning to the hippie hippie shake line. Anyway, it doesn't really ever move far away. And it only really gets broken up by the kind of good old rock and roll breaks. Like I said, the kind of like the band hitting the stops when he does the shake it to the left and shake it to the right, all that stuff. Proper, like rock around the clock kind of stuff, you know. The band hit the beat and the singer says something and it just punches and emphasises the whole thing and then they settle back in. It gives it power, doesn't it? And it's a great song. I think the difference between this and Twist and Shout, just thinking about it why this... Because they could be so close between which one you'd go with between the two is that Twist and Shout has those build-up bits, which just has a slight bit more interest to it, I think.
It's got more interesting energy, Twist and Shout. And, it has the whole, the front three singing.
Yeah, yeah.
The call and answer stuff just Paul, going on, which gives it more of an interest as a band piece.
Yeah.
So, whereas this is more of a feature for Paul.
Yes, yeah, which is why I think it puts me in mind of the Little Richard ones again that we've been doing, because he's up in his top register again.
Yeah.
And you could almost imagine it being a cover from Little Richard. But it's a good song with a nice vocal hook and relentless momentum. So I'm going to give it 71 for music.
Right out.
Performance. I mean, I'll take this as kind of an amalgam between the two, because I didn't sit and listen to it side by side with the one that from the... Volume 1, But I thought this was a good, solid performance of it as anyway. Just a different performance of it. We've got his amazing rock and roll screaming voice again. And yeah. I think he's on a par with his singing in like Kansas City when he's doing this kind of vocal. I think it's quite a good take, actually, his vocal on this.
Yeah, no, I think it is. It definitely is.
The guitar solo is really good too. Very tight, well worked out.
Yeah, he plays that based on the record as well.
Okay.
As if you listen to the Swinging Blue Jeans, it's got a very similar guitar solo because they're both based on the original record.
Yeah. So that, yeah, he's got it down, I should say. Yeah, the backbeat of the band chuntering along is great, very unified. You really get the feeling of them being locked in on this. You know, and Ringo's fills and flourishes in the breaks and the sections between the sections, you know, the transitions don't drop a beat and just roll on. Yeah, it's a good performance of a good song. I'm going to give it a high 87 for performance.
Yowza.
Because, I think it would have been a great one to see them play.
Yeah, it definitely would. I think this is one they used to open a lot of their sets with. Because so can you imagine, this is your starting point. Yeah. It's like, well, blimey, Where we're going from here.
Yeah, exactly. So song choice, as we've established, I already thought they'd done this somewhere, at least until you told me they hadn't. It suits them very, very much by that token. It could have been an alternative Twist and Shout, but, the only reason I imagine is because they had Twist and Shout that there was no need for it, really.
That's essentially it. You know, they had so much stuff and you only have so much time on records.
Yeah.
You can't put everything on there and you have to choose certain things. Yeah. And so this goes by the wayside from the Beatles and it gets picked up by the Blue Jeans, who do their own version of it, which is a smash hit.
Did they ever get close? Is there any... It hasn't popped up on anything else we've done yet, but was there any... Did they ever try a studio version that didn't get anywhere? No. Okay. Oh. You'd have thought they'd at least have had just stomped it out during just in case it came together. I probably couldn't be bothered. Maybe they were fed up of it if they played it a lot.
Possibly.
You know. Anyway, I've given it 78 for song choice because it so nearly could have been a song that we would have completely just have swapped it out and it would have made a lot of sense. So that gives it 78.7 altogether.
Yeah, I will say they did this 5 times for the BBC. Right. So you've got a version on Live at the BBC 1, Live at the BBC 2, and there's a version on the Bootlegs 1963 album, all of which, so that's all official releases of it.
Right.
Yeah, and what I didn't mention, I must mention it now before I forget, is that song we did before, which was Lend Me Your Comb, that's also on Anthology 1, so people might know that from there as well. Yeah,
okay. Was that... What version?
Same thing.
Same one. Yeah. Okay, brilliant.
Right. Shall we carry on?
Yes, carry on.
Oh, how are they? Okay, so after the hippie shake, we get Roll Over Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get a version of There's a Place, which, I could have picked, but I've been trying to avoid doing Lennon McCartney ones as much as possible. But it's interesting that There's a Place, they do play that quite a few times, because a few versions of that are on the live bootleg 1963 version.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a little speech track called Bumper Bundle. Then we have P.S. I Love You. Please, Mr. Postman. Then we come to track 26, Beautiful Dreamer. Beautiful dreamer.
Beautiful dreamer, Paul.
Have you been watching me sleep again?
No.
It's not good. I will I don't know whether I should say this, but the other night I was in bed and I was fast asleep and then suddenly I heard my partner go, "Wah!" And she just made a strange, terrifying noise in her sleep.
Oh, right.
So rather than sleep talking something interesting, she just... my heart almost leapt out of my mouth. It was terrifying.
So, yeah. Did she later tell you what the...
I think she could remember as well what the circumstance was. So I got the full vivid description. Anyway, there you go.
So not so more of a shocking, horrified dreamer.
Yes, I think that was the thing. Mm. Yeah, I'll probably get in trouble for revealing that now. You know. Oh, anyway,
fine.
It's the only dream-based thing I could think of.
That's okay.
Let's move on from that.
Tell us about Beautiful Dreamer then.
Okay, so this is a Beatles version from... So this is the other really interesting, unique thing on this album.
Mm.
This is from Saturday Club on the 26th of January 1963, recorded a few days earlier. And this is based on a version of the song by Tony Orlando.
Right, okay.
So Tony Orlando puts out a single of this, which is exactly what the Beatles based their version on.
Right, okay.
And that's only just come out in, I think literally in the UK at the start of January. So this is one where they've learnt it in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I've got a feeling that they've kind of learnt it because they think it's silly.
Yeah.
It's quite a silly rocker, this one. But, the original song is, if no one knows Beautiful Dreamer, it was written in, well, it was published anyway in 1864. Mm. Written by Stephen Foster, who is one of the sort of godfathers of American popular music.
Right.
In the sense that he wrote hundreds of songs in his lifetime, many of which were, most of which were in the minstrel tradition. Mm. I mean, there's a whole other story about minstrelsy and all that stuff that's way beyond the scope of talking about this.
Mm.
But he wrote things that people would know, like Camp Down Races.
Oh, right.
Camp Town Races, sorry, which I used to have on a Fisher-Price record thing when I was little. And songs like I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, which is actually referred to in this song.
Right.
So, yeah, I've known Beautiful Dreamer for a long time because I think it was on... like in one of the books of music we used to have in the house, not one that I would have bought or been learning from. So it might have been a chord book or something that Dad had or something like that, with a few songs in the back.
It doesn't ring a bell to me. But
no, I have only the vaguest memory of it, but Beautiful Dreamer was one of the ones in there. And so I'd played that on the piano. It goes, Beautiful Dreamer, wait unto me. So obviously it's from the 1860s. It's not going to go like the version the Beatles do.
No.
So Jerry Goffin and Jack Keller get hold of it and do this new version that Tony Orlando does.
Yeah.
I believe Roy Orbison did a traditional version of it, though.
Yeah. When I was trying to figure out, I didn't do a huge amount of research. I just trying to find out what the original was and realised, oh, the original was very old. The Roy Orbison one was the one that was popping up, so I thought, oh, I didn't know the one that you've mentioned existed, so I didn't know if this was the Beatles going, let's do a fast version of that, but they're aping someone else who'd already had that idea.
Yes.
Yeah. But so yeah, there's a Roy Orbison one, it's, he's just crooning it.
Yeah, because it's a strange one. It's a sort of waltz, but it's not actually 3/4, it's a 9/8.
Right.
So it's rather than 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and you know it's got a funny feel to it. But then this version is the rocker version that they do. So they've taken Stephen Foster. It's been updated. They've done their version of his version.
Their version of his version of the traditional by the sense that it's old. So not really traditional, just old, because we know who wrote it and we know when. So, this has some... Yeah, it's a very interesting... It's another one that we have quality problems with, so it's not great quality to listen to, but it just seems to settle down after a little while. I don't know if it's not... if the quality is also jars a little bit with the fact that it's a very different type of standard to some of the other ones, so you're like, oh, what's happening here then? But I don't know how well it translates as a pop rock song, because the closest it comes to a really good chorus is right at the end, when although it's just repeating itself, they settle into a beautiful dreamer, da, 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 and they kind of go round it a few times, and then they do a key change weirdly.
Yeah,
right at the
last. A good old key step up.
But it's like for like one bar, and then they kind of end. And they kind of feel like they're only in the hooky bit feels like it only really gets there at the end. Before that, although they are pretty much doing the same chord and stuff, it doesn't settle down enough. It's got that weird thing because of the kind of major chords going up the scale that make it lose all of its teeth that you would get from normal rock and roll and make it more poppy sounding. But yeah, then it is based on a 19th century song, so you know, it's a strange.
It's like I say, the version that they're basing their version on is quite silly anyway.
Yeah.
It's got the piano, it's basically got the piano going dun 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 rather than a rock and roll beat.
Right.
It's quite sort of boxing gloves on the piano type playing, really.
Right, okay.
It's got a mad brass section and sort of loopy sort of female like answering backing vocals.
Okay.
It's quite over the top, and Tony Orlando does quite a good screamy vocal on it, but I don't think it's supposed to be taken particularly seriously.
Yeah, and I get...
And then the Beatles have listened to it for presumably a fortnight, is the most they could have heard this for, and have gone, that's silly, let's do our version of it as well. Yeah, Paul gets to do some screaming, but they get to do this weird...
Which I've got in the performance bit of it to talk about, actually, because about that. So, but as far as the music bit, you know, I'm going to give it 50 because I just don't really think it works as a rock and roll song. It's a bit of a stretch. So 50 for music. Performance, though, then to pick up on that, I like how they give it a go at what they're doing, and Paul is really running with it. You know, the backing vocals don't add much. They're a bit ordinary by their standard. And I think what's funny, and where I think they might be having a laugh with it, like you just said, and that was my note too, is that how Paul keeps on screaming over this really short crap solo. Yeah. He's kind of like going, yeah! And then the solo's going, ding, 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 ding. He's going, woo! It's like, it's just this really short, not very underwhelming solo happens. And I don't know if it's Paul kind of going, like, let's keep the energy up, lads, or if he's just making a joke of the fact that it's a bit funny that they're doing all the rock and roll oohs and screams to something that is very kind of major chordy and not that kind of feel to it. It's hard to tell with the performance how much time they've spent practicing it, because I think it's quite noticeably not as tight as some of their other stuff.
No, well, they can't have spent that long practicing it.
It's not one that's come out of that they've played millions of times, is it, obviously? Because,
no, not at all.
So, yeah, I'm not sure if they're just having a little laugh with it. Like you said, that's exactly what my note was. So I've given it 53 for performance as well, because, you know, if you're going to rank it, it's not going to come out as one of the best ones when it's relatively new. It's a very strange provenance song and they're just having a bit of a laugh, maybe.
Yeah, I think they are. And I think the thing that betrays it is, one, that they stick in that, they make sure they do that funny key change. Hmm. But also they go from the bit with John and George doing their backing, and then suddenly they're all just singing it in unison, all three of them.
Yeah.
And that you never get, there's no other Beatles song where you have that circumstance where all three of them are just singing.
That's when that
exactly
feels
the
like,
same tone at the same time, same pitch at the same time, like gang vocals.
Yeah, that's when it feels like the chorus to me. But as I say, by that point, you're in the last.
Probably except for the end of Hey Jude, this is possibly the only time you get all three of them doing
unison.
Exactly the same notes at the same time.
Oh, that's a good fact.
I have to think about that. That I think that must be the case, surely. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so on to song choice, though. I would say that despite of all this, I like the idea that they've continued a tradition of reviving traditional songs into something new. I mean, they haven't continued it, they've just copied it. But they obviously like that. And actually, when you think about Golden Slumbers, you know, and there's something else which Paul took his words from, isn't there, as well? Where, you know, you take a traditional song and update it and...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think that's great. I think that's music talking to time.
Oh, Gary, that's very deep.
Yeah.
In the sense that it means absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I know what you mean. Maybe this is a sort of thing where they've sort of gone, oh, wow, you can take that crummy old classic.
And do something with it.
And do something with it. Maybe, you know, maybe this is one of the ways that those doors open in their mind.
Yeah, and which is exactly what he did with Golden Slumbers, isn't it? Except that he didn't. Yep. He redid the music, but he sat there using the words and the idea about it. So, yeah, I'm going to give it some more points for this category, just because I feel bad for its other categories. And because they've just gone off the beaten track a little, and that's a bit of fun, and it's always worth doing that when you're rapidly becoming a very successful band and they're still wanting to develop and figure things out. So it's good. I'm going to give it 65 for song choice as an interesting deviation from their normal kind of stuff. and to push it up, its average up to all of 56. So,
oh, fair enough. I will also like to mention that probably one of the first times I heard this, and it suddenly came back to me today, was hearing Bugs Bunny singing it to a sleeping Elmer Fudd in one of the Bugs Bunny cartoons. Yeah. I remember hearing it, and I looked it up today, and it's in a cartoon where Elmer Fudd appears to have taken a lot of sleeping pills, which have a, there's a bottle that says sleeping pills, and it's got a little quote on it, take D's and Doe's. and then I believe Bugs Bunny takes some tablets himself and joins Elmer Fudd in a dream, which is quite high concept.
Yeah. So, well, life is but a dream, and this is a... what's the word? It's nursery rhyme type of... what's the word? It's a nursery rhyme, isn't it?
So, yeah, nursery rhyme. Lullaby.
A lullaby type of
melody,
so yeah.
Right. Shall we move on?
Yeah.
Okay, so we get to a version of Devil in Her Heart as track 27, and we have another speech track called The 49 Weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to track 29, Sure to Fall in Love with You.
I'm sure to fall.
Sure to fall in love with you, Paul.
Everyone does when they meet me. This is a simple fact. I'm very compelling. That's definitely not true.
Oh, it is, Paul.
Thank you. My address for letters is... So, Sure to Fall in Love with You. It's another Carl Perkins number.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Paul singing this with John. So again, it's got the same sort of Carl Perkins harmony stuff as when we were talking about Lend Me Your Comb going on. But this is an original Carl Perkins number rather than him covering another song. It was supposed to be the follow-up single after Blue Suede Shoes, but it didn't come out as a single. So it ends up on an album called Dance Album of Carl Perkins.
Right.
Which I love as an album title.
The Dance Album.
Yeah. Dance Album of Carl Perkins.
Yeah.
I mean, it was later put out again under the phrase... Teen Beat, the best of Carl Perkins, which is a bit more, hey kids.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is on the Pop Goes the Beatles on the 24th of September 1963, recorded on the 3rd of September 1963. There's a version of this on the first BBC album. They do a version of this for the Decca audition, which is atrocious.
Right.
Really, really poor Beatles. I'm sad to say unfortunately, it really is Pete's fault on that one. It's, I mean, yeah, they're all nervous, and Paul does a stupid voice,
right,
on the Decca audition version, but Pete cannot get the sort of internal swing you need, for it to work. He's really goes weird on the hi hats and stuff like that. So I think it's just a part of the reason that session bombed for them is they just couldn't pull this sort of thing together in that lineup. But I think this is just great. I love the version on the first Live at the BBC album, partly because the way George reproduces the guitar solo sound on it, I think is great.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, I mean, one thing's for sure, this is definitely country music, isn't it? You can't argue me with genre. You can't genre shame me for this one. This is country with a capital.
Yeah, I mean, whereas a lot of Carl Perkins stuff is rockabilly, this is more on the country and western end.
Yeah, the only other song I can think of that's as country as this in their kind of canon is Chains. You know, it's similar. That's the nearest one I can think for. It's kind of like...
Or Act Naturally.
Act Naturally is just slightly more boppy though, isn't it? And it's slightly less... I can hear slide guitars all over this, and Act Naturally, although it's country, it's. Is there something about that low harmony? The kind of low harmonies they're held on vocals, the tempo, the general shuffle and lilt of it, that makes it so country compared to loads of other Carl Perkins-y stuff that they do. But it is. Decidedly so, and I'm not sure how I feel about it. I like country, but it's a broad church, as all genres are. And this is the very gentle swaying end of that church, rather than the more hitch up your skirts type of and have a good dance. This is a bit more have a very slow dance around a barn, maybe. It's pleasant though. It has some nice harmony and chord changes, and it's the kind of thing I imagine would have crossed over into the folk musicians of our. I can imagine something like our dad might have played in the 70s as a, you know, they sometimes
as a folky.
Sorry,
as a folky. It's got nothing to do with distressing industrial mill accidents of the 1800s.
No, but I think they sometimes they. It's a cousin with country, isn't it? The folk music, and I think they.
Well, yes. It is.
Yeah, no, it's yeah, but then I don't. It's a nice song, but I think it might be a personal preference thing. So I'm still going to give it 65 for music. Yeah, I don't have much else to say about it. It's a very country song. I think the performance. I've got more to say about it.
Well,
what do you think
about that?
Okay, I'll talk about the performance then. So I'd never heard this before at all, so it's quite different to hear them doing something that's so out and out country, and it almost has a bit of a pastiche feel to it for them, if you know what I mean. It sounds like the Beatles playing cowboys. Like I could almost imagine them whipping out the cowboy hats before they play this to kind of like it's.
I don't think it's quite as much. It's not the Blues Brothers band in doing Rawhide.
I think it is. I think it's the good old boys Beatles doing the good old boys.
You're going to look pretty funny eating corn on the cob with no teeth.
What?
That's a reference to the film, The Blues Brothers, not me just being really rude.
I've forgotten that line, Paul. So for me, that was just an out-and-out threat. No. Yeah. I know the genre influenced them, and you can hear that in the song. And I don't think that harmonies in the verses, I think it feels strange to hear them doing that kind of low harmony. It doesn't fit with them right. It's a bit lower and wobblier than they're usually dealing with, and I think it knocks them a little here and there on the performance. So it's not as tight as it normally would be, because it's just a strange range for them, I think. But they deliver the song more or less intact. I think it's just seems a bit of a waste of the Beatles to have something so subdued and gentle. The guitar bits are nice, but it's quite slow, so they really should be. But there's nice. I like the double picking and hammer on bits they do.
Think George plays brilliantly on this, and yeah. It sounds just like the original record, because it's a bit of a funny guitar style to play, that sort of flutter picking.
Yeah,
style.
Oh, it is, yeah.
And he gets it sort of spot on, I think, on both of the versions that they release. So.
But so that's good. Paul's doing an okay vocal. It's interesting about what you said about the Decca, because he's not doing a country voice on this. So it'd be quite. I can understand how it would be quite grating if he did try and make it a bit. You know, do a bit of a voice. He's doing it quite straight on this, I think, which, yeah.
He is, yeah.
So that gives it 61 for performance, which so it's not bad. So song choice then. Yeah, for me, it feels, rather than doing a take on a genre or owning a genre, like just doing a genre, like, you know, like a novelty departure from their usual stuff to do a more country song. Unlike something like Act Naturally, which I think starts to go towards the rock and rolly end of country. So I don't know that they necessarily make this their own.
I think one thing that's hard to tell now is that the Beatles could be quite a countryish band in their live incarnation and in some of the song choices. It was noted in like their audition for the BBC about that they were more country and western than many bands were. But we don't really get that feel. In terms of our perspective on what they end up releasing, and that includes all this stuff as well.
That's it. It's definitely in the mix massively, but they definitely don't go down that. I'm quite glad they don't, because I just think it would have been a cul-de-sac if they'd gone too far down that avenue. But what they do is they incorporate bits of it as they go forwards, don't they? And we still end up with things like Rocky Raccoon later on, which kind of, you know, almost develop the genre. But it's good for a show, but I can't hear it anywhere near a record, other than the Chains is the nearest I can hear them do, but that had the more energy and more harmonies and the kind of that suited them, I think. So I'm going to give it 53 for song choice, which gives it 59.7 overall.
Okay, well, I can also tell people that I mean, it clearly meant a lot to them because there's you can see footage of Paul sort of sitting with Carl Perkins playing a version of it with him.
Yeah.
And I believe George did a version on a Carl Perkins tribute in the 80s. And Ringo records a version of it with Paul on it as well in 1981, which is atrocious, unfortunately. And so, yeah, it meant a lot to them, this song.
Oh, well, that's nice for them. It's not their podcast, though,
is
it?
Not for you.
Yeah, okay. Great stuff. So we've got a couple left. Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, we've only got a couple more after that, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah.
We have a speech track called Nevermind, where they sort of dedicate a number to each other.
Yeah.
And it does sound at one point like they all sort of forget who's in the band with them. They're having to think about
who's not, saying, who
well,
they're
I'm
going to
do this. Yeah. Which one am I not?
which one am I not? Oh, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. But then they sort of launch into Twist and Shout. And then we have a funny little thing called Bye Bye, a little speech track where they sort of say goodbye to the program that they've been doing. And like I say, then there's a couple of interview tracks on here with John and George, which are really interesting listens, but sort of beyond the scope of what we're talking about now.
Great stuff. Well, there we are then. Disc one, volume two, is done. And we now have a chart of 15 of the live at the BBC songs to be finished next week with the last five. And so I'll do all 15 because it's only brief. And
we can manage that.
I think we can. And it goes like this. At number 15, The Honeymoon Song. At number 14, Keep Your Hands Off My Baby. Beautiful Dreamer at number 13. Lend Me Your Comb at number 12. At number 11, Nothing Shaking. I'm Talking About You at number 10. Youngblood is number 9. Sure to Fall in Love with You at number 8. Lonesome Tears in My Eyes at number 7. Don't Ever Change at number 6. I Just Don't Understand at 5. At number 4, Ooh My Soul. Soldier of Love at number 3. The Hippie Hippie Shake at number 2. And To Know Her is to Love Her at number 1. There we go.
Weird.
Why is that weird?
It's just weird. It's just me getting into talking about how you end up rating things and you sound like you're really down on something and then it turns out to be six places above something I think is so much better than it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks again, Paul. And we shall continue next week then with the last of this little run of Live at the BBC. So I shall see you then.
Okay. Bye.
So goodbye, everybody.
Bye. And don't have nightmares.